Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure once again to present Ed Haslam, the author of the vitally important recent book, Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, which deals with a number of things raging, as seemingly disparate as the Kennedy assassination and the contamination of the polio vaccine and others with a cancer-causing monkey virus called SV40. Now, in our last half hour, we were discussing an article from the Atlantic Monthly's issue of February of the year 2000. It's entitled The Virus and the Vaccine. It's by Debbie Bookchin and Jim Schumacher, again, Atlantic Monthly, February of 2000. And this article, Ed, supplements and confirms in a wonderful and yet terrifying way your boilerplate research. And let's jump right in with Michele Carbone and the mesothelioma cancer, one that, like many others that you've talked about, has increased in incidence and the links to the SV40. Take it from there, Ed, if you
will. Okay. When I published Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus back in 1995, I really felt like I was a lone voice in the wilderness talking about the contamination of the polio vaccine, which is a subject that a lot of people don't know about, and a lot of people, frankly, don't want to hear about. But it is so important in terms of our national health, and 1 out of 10 people that you know are either going to have breast cancer or prostate cancer. And a lot of the evidence, in my opinion, connects these events. Now, what I like about this Atlantic Monthly article is that it summarizes the research that has been going on in the last 5 years, since my book was published, about this very important subject. One of the major players in this is Dr. Michele Carbone, who has been investigating tumors, looking for viruses in tumors. He is the main subject of this article, but they also get into other really important people like Janet Butel down in Texas, who has also been doing important research into SV40 and exactly how it works. And you will learn a lot about the mechanics of how cancer is formed and all that in this article, but not in a laborious or technical manner, but in a nice, readable manner. This is a fabulous article. This article also addresses the other side of this story, which is why we don't know about it and why people have not talked about it. And I'm just going to read a quick paragraph here from the article, which really makes this point. It talks about as Carbone was getting his research started at the National Institute of Health. It says, quote, "Others at the National Institutes of Health, including some of the scientists who had been around at the time of the contamination scare, were less receptive to the novel theory. They told Carbone that the last thing anyone wanted to hear was that the exalted polio vaccine was linked to cancer. Too much was at stake. Implicating a vaccine contaminant in cancer, even if the contamination occurred some 40 years ago, might easily shake public confidence in vaccines in general." I mean, that's a bold-faced admission that they were willing to lie to protect the authority of the public health establishment.
And jumping in for just a second, one of the things that the critics of, is it pronounced Carbone? I've been pronouncing it Carbone. Is it Carbone?
Carbone is the way that I have always heard it referred to. I've never met the man personally, so I don't know Italian, so you know, I call him Carbone, but it's spelled
Carbone. Right. And the man, like yourself, in my opinion, is a genuine hero. One of the points that the critics have made is that the presence of the SV40 is in all likelihood a laboratory contaminant. And there are a couple of points that were made, not only disproving, not only taking issue with that, but ultimately someone who was skeptical of SV40, a fellow named Ozzy Gadar, developed a test that absolutely disproved that.
Yes, and he's a cancer specialist down at the University of Texas, and he was not involved in this debate on one side or another. He just saw an opportunity to take a technique that he works with, which is a laser-based microscopic technique, which can separate out certain types of infected cells from other types of cells, And so what he said was, well, maybe the technique that I use can help resolve this issue. And he admits that when he went into this, he was leaning to the side against Carboni.
Right.
And said that when he did his experiments, and he found that, it was just blatant evidence that certain cells, which were either cancerous or precancerous, all had SV40 in them, and the cells that were normal, healthy cells did not have SV40 in them.
Absolutely, in so doing, disproving the arguments that have been raised against Carboni's arguments. Ed, people may not be familiar with the scientific methodology involved. Carboni and others had criticized the NCI as not only their opposition, but what appears to be a very flawed study by pointing out that if contaminants were the reason for even the NCI admitted the presence of SV40 in tumors, that this would have been in the controls as well. If you would explain that to us from a methodological standpoint.
Well, the whole perspective of viruses causing cancer is confused by a couple of really basic points. One is there is a model in people's heads about how viruses cause disease. And this goes all the way back to Louis Pasteur and the Pasteur Institute. And the way that a virus causes cancer is not the same way as it causes disease. Okay? It's a whole different mechanism. And it involves the way it causes cancers. It gets inside the cell and it starts messing with the DNA and it causes a problem with the DNA. And therefore, there's a whole bunch of ideas that relate to people thinking about how viruses work off of the normal disease model that don't relate. For example, numbers count, meaning that if you have a lot of viruses, you're going to have a lot of disease. If you have a little virus, you're going to have a little disease. Okay, that's irrelevant in this, because all you have to have to cause a tumor is one little virus go in and change one little gene on one little cell. So you don't have to have thousands of them swimming around in the bloodstream in order to create the problem. You can have an extremely small number. And one of the things is that our body's main defense, the immune system, tends to look for numbers. And it tends to get alarmed and organize and respond when it sees large numbers. And when some things happen in very small numbers, it doesn't respond as much. And so part of the argument from the government's point of view of saying, oh, this isn't really what's happening here, has been we haven't found the big numbers that we would normally find in a virus contamination that would produce a problem. Well, that's kind of an irrelevant point here. And what Carboni very successfully proved, and I think this article does a great job of explaining, is that not only is it irrelevant, but sometimes, in terms of getting past the immune system's protection layers, that smaller numbers are even more dangerous than bigger numbers because the immune system is not responding to it. And this is the type of point that this article makes so well. And another thing was they were doing certain tests in petri dishes and stuff, and they'd say, okay, we try to grow this thing, and most of the viruses we deal with, we see them in 14 days, okay? So we do this test for 14 days, and we don't see any viruses, and therefore we declare it's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Carboni goes back and does the same test and lets it go on for 19, 20 days, and the viruses show up.
Yep, and one of the points that is made in the article is that, and actually one of the other criticisms voiced by NCI, which is disproved in this article, was that there's a significant genetic difference between the SV40 that's found today and the SV40 that is found in the tumors, and that the SV40 found in the tumors appears to be much more, actually perhaps I'm transposing this, the SV40 found in the tumors is faster growing than the SV40 found today. He pointed out that there are two types of SV40 in the original vaccine, and that one of them, as you pointed out, eludes the standard screening methods.
Carboni actually found some old doctor in Chicago that had a couple of batches of polio vaccine in a refrigerator, the original stuff from the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
and was able to get his hands on it, was able to actually genetically compare the SV40 that he found in the polio vaccine itself with the SV40 that he pulled out of the cancer tumors of people years later and found them to be identical.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's as much of a smoky pistol as I think you're ever going to get on this thing. And the other point that kind of goes along with that is the explanation of exactly how this thing works, which Janet Buttel down in Texas was so instrumental in developing. One of the questions that people have asked me, because one of the things that happened in the polio vaccine distribution was the Scandinavians refused it.
Yep.
Okay. And so there are some countries that did not get the polio vaccine until after this problem was resolved. Okay. And the Scandinavians, frankly, just weren't as afraid of polio as the Americans were, and they were not willing to accept. They knew the thing was loaded with strange viruses that they didn't understand, and they were not willing to inoculate their populations with things they didn't understand to get rid of one disease they weren't concerned about. Okay? And so one of the countries that never got it was Finland. All right? And Finland has an extremely low rate of pleural mesotheliomas, and Carboni was able to go get samples from Finland, and none of them have SV40 in them. So you can have a mesothelioma without it being caused by the SV40. But the point is, there's no SV40 in Finland. There's none in their tumors, and this extremely low rate of mesotheliomas in tumors in Finland. Now, Dave, you remember when I was speaking in Los Angeles, and you came to that bookstore? There was that environmentalist down there who started getting in my face about a lot of stuff.
Yes, I do.
And his point was that mesotheliomas were caused by asbestos, and it was all being caused by corporations and industrial pollutants and everything else. And I sort of said, well, you know, I'm not going to get into that with you. There's evidence that something else is going on here. And so that point has always been sort of a point that's been floating around in my head, is that I don't consider myself at odds with environmentalists, okay? But we seem to have a different perspective on this particular subject of what's causing these mesotheliomas. And what this article does, this Atlantic Monthly article, does a very nice job in is getting into that subject and explaining that both asbestos and SV40 create the conditions for cancer in this mesothelioma scenario. Okay, so it's not one or the other. And it's the first time, and Carboni points this out very nicely, it's the first time somebody has actually developed a scientifically palatable model where we understand how environmental pollutants and viruses are working together to create certain diseases. And as Carboni says in very blunt language in the article, he says SV40 is, there's no question that SV40 is a human carcinogen, and you don't want it in your body, okay?
He also describes it as a perfect little war machine, and he may have had more truth in that than he understood at the time he's made this statement. Ed, talking about the SV40 and how it causes cancer, bearing in mind one of the points that was made, which is that there are two types of SV40, one of which develop much more quickly and the other of which develops much more slowly. That was initially a criticism against Carboni. It turns out that there are two types, and the slower type, precisely because it takes longer to develop, appears to be more carcinogenic. But in talking about the SV40, Ed, the article centers on a protein called large T antigen and the many ways it causes cellular damage. Tell us about that.
Well, T-antigen is a protein that's basically kind of a goo, and what it does is it clogs up a very sophisticated mechanism inside the DNA, which is the P53 gene. And what P53 is a safety device in the human DNA that goes through and makes sure everything is working right, okay? Because as the body reproduces its DNA, it's doing a lot of complex chemical stuff, and it doesn't always go right. And so P53, one of its roles is to flag it when it goes wrong and destroy the cell. And so that is the mechanism through which our body prevents cancer from developing. And the T antigen, as is explained in this article, basically binds to that P53 site so that it's gunked up and is not being able to perform its task properly. That's it in a nutshell.
It also neutralizes proteins called RBs, which help to prevent cancer. It also, according to the article, explodes chromosomes, or it basically can either delete or replace entire sections of chromosomes. So one of the observers said it looks like a bomb has exploded in the nucleus of the cell. The slow-growth SV40 appears to be even more carcinogenic than the rapid-growth SV40, and also a German study found a possible hit-and-run aspect of SV40, in that it may go in, cause cells to be cancerous, and then leave without any detection. Ed, do you have any idea how that might have happened, the hit-and-run aspect? That was not clear to me from the article.
No, but what I'm saying about this article is, you don't have to be a scientist to read it. I mean, for example, this point you made about the, it looked like a bomb went off inside the cell, okay? Mm-hmm. They have a photo, side-by-side photos, of the chromosomes of a normal healthy cell versus one that has been infected by SV40. And anybody who can see the pictures there can see what a big difference the infection makes in terms of the ability of the inner mechanics of the cell to work properly. And all these articles, that all this research tends to be horribly technical stuff, okay? And the original articles tend to be very technical things. And what I like about this Atlantic Monthly article is it kind of goes through and footnotes the key points on all these things so that a person who's not a medical person and not a scientific professional can see very clearly that there is substance to this whole issue. Trying to get the public to understand that this is a real thing is I think, one of the things that's driven me along here. And when, just if you go to an internet search engine and you type in SV40, today you'll find over 500 articles on it. If you type in monkey virus, you'll find over 12,000 things, though some of them relate to a computer virus called the monkey virus. But there's a lot of information out there today available to anybody who wants to know, which proves very clearly that this is not some kind of lunatic fringe idea that somebody made up. This is something that the scientific community knows about and is researching, and the weight of opinion has started to shift. And this Atlantic Monthly article is not the first announcement in the mainstream press. In fact, the other night I found something on ABC News, of all places, on their internet site called The Monkey Connection, which talks about SV40 and causing disease, in particular cancer, and talks about the contamination of the polio vaccine. And Atlantic Monthly is based in Boston, and one of the first really major articles that came out was an article in the Boston Globe back in 1996 called A Shot in the Dark, which talked about the same subject we've been talking about here. The difference between this Atlantic Monthly article and that original Boston Globe article is 5 years of medical research, all of which supports the concept that the contamination of the polio vaccine is causing cancer. And the slightly different position I have versus Carboni's position, Carboni has gone after mesotheliomas. He's gone after one very clear, very specific example, and he's expanded that a little bit to some bone cancers and stuff like that. I'm saying, if you look at the statistics of the National Cancer Institute in terms of what has really happened in the population of the United States concerning cancer with these four soft tissue cancers, this problem is probably a whole lot bigger than anything anybody has talked about.
Go ahead, Ed.
And one of the quotes they have from Janet Buttel in this article says pretty much the same thing. I mean, she doesn't talk about the soft tissue cancer, but she says this may be going on in a lot of other cancers as well. We just haven't looked and confirmed it. And the soft tissue cancers, soft tissues tend to grow and die and change and metabolize a lot faster than some slow tissues do. Okay? So all tissues in the body don't change at the same speed. So the personality of each of these cells has to do with whether or not there's still evidence in there. One of the cancers they get into a lot in this article are brain cancers.
Mm-hmm. Which also I should add, are increasing in terms of frequency dramatically in children.
Right. And when I came to the Bay Area out there at your invitation and spoke, one of the things I was able to show on the blackboard there was the only reason I did not include brain cancer in the four soft tissue cancers was the increase, which happened in children, had already happened before this 16-year window that we were looking at. And so the increase in brain cancer during that 16-year window was 10% and was considerably higher than the zero. In fact, if I had taken brain out of the other 36, the other 36 would have actually had a negative number in there instead of just being zero. So brain cancer is certainly one of the cancers that there's been a lot of medical articles published on connecting it to SV40.
A couple of points in this context, Ed. One of the things that's maintained in the article about large T antigen is that it is the most oncogenic protein ever discovered. Because people say, so what? You know, that makes this something that needs to be looked into. Another point that the article makes, and this is something we've spoken about in past discussions, is that there is evidence that the virus may be sexually communicable. It's certainly present in semen. And we've also discussed the possibility it might be passed from mother to child, perhaps in breast milk. I wonder, maybe I'm betraying nothing so much as my own medical and scientific ignorance, but two of the cancers you noted as increasing were breast and prostate. The relationship between those glands and, on the one hand, semen and the other, breast milk, would certainly appear evident under the circumstances.
Yeah, it certainly would get my attention looking at it from the top.
Yeah, again, talk about its presence in semen. This is apparently a sexually communicable virus.
Well, one of the things that the Italians were able to establish at, I think it was at the University of Ferrara, was they found SV40 in the semen of 45% of the otherwise healthy Italian males that they examined. And I think that is a self-evident statement in terms of whether or not it's sexually communicable.
I would also point out that
That's also going to screw up your epidemiology if you look to say who got the polio vaccine and who's got the cancer, because it doesn't matter which one you got, if it's sexually transmittable.
Susan Fisher, one of the points that you made, Ed, I want to underscore, which is that the scientific and medical credentials of the people who are now jumping on the SV40 bandwagon, so to speak, are very, very impressive indeed. And as Susan Fisher points out, that it may be impossible to find a control group that is not exposed to SV40. We're getting down to the last few minutes of this interview, Ed, and one of the points that Carboni makes is that the standard screening procedure for vaccines to eliminate viral contaminants is a 14-day light microscope procedure, which is not only 40 years old plus, but which would not detect the slow growth SV40, which takes 19 days at least to culture. This is not an academic consideration, and one of the things that you brought up this past week as we were talking, Ed, is that you are wrestling in your own personal and familial life with the possible implications of viral contaminants in vaccines. I wonder if you'd touch on that for us.
Well, I would prefer to talk about Carboni's point there, and that is one of the points that I have always made about why I get on the radio and talk about this, is the fact that we need to wake up with this. And one of my other points is the fact that I'm sort of in favor of, I have sort of an amnesty perspective on this thing, which says I don't want to take people out and lynch them. What I want to do is solve the problem.
Sure.
Okay? And Carboni's point is the fact, my reaction to Carboni's point is very much that if we don't acknowledge what this problem is and what the procedural problems, such as the light microscope testing technique, et cetera, are, if we don't create an environment that people can openly discuss the mechanics and the mechanisms and whether or not our current safety procedures are really addressing the real threat, et cetera, we're not going to make any progress on fighting this. And so we need people like Carboni and like Harvey Pass and like Janet Butel to have open access to discuss the depth of this problem and what can be done about it without them fearing for their political or professional lives in the process of it. And that's what I think is really the critical issue here, is the fact that this Atlantic Monthly article is the first real in-depth presentation in what I will call the mainstream media of the scientific evidence supporting this thing. And that's the type of thing that needs to occur in order for us to get to where we need to be so that hopefully we can figure out some kind of solution to this stuff.
Yeah, one of the points that I want to close with, Ed, is that people may think that politics is something far away and irrelevant. In the end, politics has a lot to do with the health of not only oneself, but also one's loved ones, and that this virus, which produces the most oncogenic protein ever discovered, according to the article, is not only in vaccines apparently today, certainly that's the implication, but it also is sexually communicable. People are catching it who may not even have gotten it from a vaccine. And people may think that, well, this stuff is a long ways away, or the Kennedy assassination is irrelevant. The bottom line is you get to the bottom of the events at Dealey Plaza and you come across this as well. The health of the body politics, so to speak, and the health of one's individual body are not at all dissociated.
The most disturbing thing that I see in people's responses to this that relates to what you just outlined is the attitude that we shouldn't talk about this because people in power might not like it.
And by the way, Ed, we're down to our last minute. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yep.
And those people only get their power from us in the first place. And frankly, I don't care whether or not they like it. You know, this is our country, and these are our children, and these are our bodies, and our health, and everything else. And we've got to fix this stuff, and we just cannot rely on the technocrats to take care of us.
2 points, Ed. Give us the Atlantic Monthly website again, if you would.
It's www.theatlantic.com. Just type in monkey virus. And to get the book, you can go to amazon.com and type in monkey virus.
And if you would also, this past week you related a song lyric that you once wrote that I find very relevant. I wonder if I could get you to repeat that.
Okay, this goes back quite a ways, but it's, we walked into the shadow, one step at a time, and then startled by its darkness, we lit our path with rhyme.
Indeed, and how much our path may be lit by rhyme, I suppose, is open to debate. I think people should take the bit in their mouths and run with it. I would suggest very emphatically that people get a copy of this article, read it, analyze it, try faxing it to people. Fax it to talk show hosts and others who in turn can disseminate the information the way the virus itself appears to be getting disseminated. That concludes this interview. We've been visiting with Ed Haslam. Ed, let me tell you that in my opinion you are an authentic American hero and someone that deserves probably more credit than you're ever going to get.
Thank you very much, Dave.
And for Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.